From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll get some background on the proposal to charge for parking at some county parks.
The county executive claimed that the pay-to-park program would generate $1.6 million in new revenue for the county. But this is not backed up with data.
Later, a new museum exhibit looks at the alliance between Jews and African Americans in the civil rights movement.
This is why this exhibit is so important, because it gives us a historical perspective on how people can work together, in particular, the Jewish community and African American community.
We'll speak with the playwright of Equivocation, now open at Next Act Theater, about the nature of truth in an age of lies.
And we'll hear a shocking statistic from the world of cheese.
There were more than 200,000 photos of cheese plates, especially by millennials, last year, and they expect this trend to grow.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. A controversial measure is moving its way through Milwaukee County government, the creation of a paid parking model in many of the county's parks. County Executive Chris Abley included the measure in his 2018 budget as a way to raise $1.6 million in revenue to keep the system afloat.
Some members of the county board and members of the public at large are raising concerns about the plan. They voiced those concerns a few weeks ago with a second public meeting on the topic slated for Tuesday night. Lake Effect Susan Bentz joins us in the studio to help us understand the situation a little better. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mitch.
So give us a little bit more background on how this came to be an issue.
Well, it's been an issue for a while, but 2 weeks ago, the Parks, Energy, and Environment Committee spent a great deal of time on it. Committee Chair Jason Haas wanted to make certain that county residents understand that this pay-to-park idea was penned not by the county board, but rather County Executive Chris Abley.
In the proposed budget, the county executive claimed that the pay-to-park program would generate $1.6 million in new revenue for the county. But this is not backed up with data or any other information stating how this figure was arrived at, nor in what parks would be included. Nevertheless, had the supervisors removed the proposal from the budget, we'd have had to replace that proposed, that it believed in revenue, with $1.6 million in revenue from another source.
Haas says the county board adopted amendments to bring the process into the open. In the meantime, a task force has been working out the details of the parking plan. It's looking at charging an hourly parking fee and the exact price and who would administer the program. That's all up in the air. This is Tig Whaley-Smith. He's director of the Department of Administrative Services.
And there were a couple of criteria that the work group used to establish. One is whether it's a regional draw. Does it draw patrons from outside Milwaukee County? Are there special events held there? Are there food and beverage access? What activities are there? The return on investment to make sure there's as much demand on parking to recoup the capital cost, and then also measuring public use for private benefits when parks, land, or parkways are being used for parking, not just for parking purposes, but to support other private enterprises.
So it sounds like that might include places like Lake and Whitnall Parks, which are fairly popular, might meet those criteria?
Absolutely. And in the case of those particular parks, both parking on an existing parking lots and along the street would be considered. Whaley-Smith told the committee it's essential to move this policy forward, which adds pressure here, because only with the launch of April 1st will they hit the $1.6 million goal.
So I imagine this meeting a couple weeks ago, the issue was hotly debated?
Very hotly. Whaley-Smith said the purpose of Tuesday's public meeting is to bring neighbors into the discussion, but plenty of people showed up at that meeting in January to express their displeasure. Here's just a few of those voices.
He's pressing April 1st. Feels a little like a steamroller. Feels like there is no openness, that there is not a call for citizens to actually say what they feel. Ask me for a dollar. I'll give you a dollar. I'll give you a dollar every month for the park.
I think this would be one of the most significant changes in the use of our park system. So I recommend, if this truly results in a $1.6 million deficit to the Parks Department alone, that there may be consideration for another amendment that a separate task force, since this is such a significant change in the use of the parks, to evaluate, and this is a task force that frankly would be better represented than the task force that was focused on the paid parking program, which is heavily weighted to county employees. And that task force, there's a lot of smart people out there that could come up with alternate solutions if there truly is a $1.6 million deficit in the Parks Department that cannot be filled in any other way. I hear that that's a call, that if you don't have the solution, then we're going to move forward, or we need to move forward with it anyway. Well, if it's that important, then there should be a separate task force dedicated to coming up with that.
No less than 25 constituents came to see me about this very issue. Half a dozen of them were golfers who swore to me that if this gets put into place, they will never golf in Milwaukee County again. Some of them, their kids participate in athletic activities that if they had to pay to park to be with their children while they participated in these activities, they would never have their children participate in athletic activities in a Milwaukee County park ever again. I am vehemently opposed to this. I don't know exactly what the answer might be, but I got numerous phone calls during the course of the day, several emails. Not a single solitary constituent of mine is in favor of this, and I'm here to represent them. So I cannot support this.
That last voice belongs to Supervisor Dan Sebring. Before that, you heard Colleen Riley and Roz Tortorna.
So were there any voices of support for this paid parking idea?
Well, actually, County Executive Chris Abley was there, something the committee chair says rarely happens. Abley says until he can convince state leaders to send more dollars back to the county, he has to turn to other means to sustain the park system.
When we invoke Whitnell and the founders of the park system here, they cared about a park system, but they cared about a sustainable park system. And I don't think you'd find any of the, you know, architects of the system we're lucky enough to have today who would say, if they were here right now, you should be indifferent to sustainability. We all wish that the state would give us more, but all of our jobs are to make decisions with not the facts we wish, but the facts that we are dealt with, the reality we have.
The committee also heard from Abley's proposed parks director, Jim Sullivan. Actually, he was there to be considered for his job. But Sullivan says no less adamantly that charging visitors for parking is the right move and that other cities, including Minneapolis and Portland, have already implemented the policy.
And I think one of the things that is being missed a little bit in this discussion is when you're talking about paid parking, one of the things that does is it takes what is an unproductive asphalt space, which is only a cost, and it converts that unproductive asphalt space to actually be supporting active programming in green space. And I think that if you can do that in an innocuous kind of way while maintaining people's access, I think that that is a pretty good thing.
So any other opportunities for the public to comment after the Tuesday public hearing?
This will be it.
All right, Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. You can find more of her coverage at WUWM.com.
An exhibit now open at Jewish Museum Milwaukee sheds light on the long alliance between African Americans and Jewish people in the civil rights movement. We'll learn more about what that alliance has looked like over the years when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tice.
And I'm Bonnie North. More than 50 years removed from the civil rights movement of the 1960s, a new Milwaukee exhibit is shining a light on the collaborative efforts of two groups in the struggle. Jewish Museum Milwaukee's exhibit, Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights, examines the relationship between Jewish and African-American people, both nationally and in Milwaukee itself.
Molly Dubin is the museum's curator. Ralph Holman is the retired president and CEO of the Milwaukee Urban League and co-chaired the exhibit planning committee. Welcome to you both.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Mitch.
So what's the story this exhibit is seeking to tell?
Well, we were really excited about the opportunity to explore the really rich history of advocacy between the Jewish and Black communities. And we had been looking at this for a while and hadn't really found the vehicle. And through some research and reaching out to some colleagues in New York and finding out about the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches and the 200 Nights of Freedom, wound up all kind of dovetailing together really nicely to enable us to develop this project.
I just wanted to add that I really think that this is a must-see exhibit because it shows both locally and nationally how the Jewish community and African-American community work together to overcome discrimination and achieve some basic civil rights. And that is so important, especially at this time in our nation's history, where we see a lot of divisions, a lot of divisiveness, hatred and bigotry, and we don't need that. And we need to show examples of how we can work together to get things done. So that's another reason why this exhibit is so important.
And I was just about to ask about some examples. What are some people or who are some people or what are some milestones along the way that you think are emblematic of how Jews and African Americans have worked together in the civil rights struggle?
Well, there are a lot of examples, and we highlight quite a few in the exhibit. I'm going to let Ralph speak to some of the beginnings of the alliance, which date to 1909 with the development of the NAACP, and I'm going to let Ralph speak to that. One of the stories that I was really excited to highlight was the relationship between Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington, which resulted in so many beneficial things. Of course, that first kind of came together when Booker T. Washington approached Rosenwald with the idea of advancing education at the Tuskegee Institute. And Rosenwald went on to establish YWCAs, YMCAs, which at the time only served whites. And probably the greatest accomplishment that came out of that relationship was the establishment of 5,500 schools in the South where there was very little access to public education for African-American children. One of the other great stories that we talk about, and is a very little-known story, is that of actually the film, which is called From Swastika to Jim Crow. And 1939-1940, of course, you know, the kind of the apex of the Nazi regime. And you have German and Austrian professors who, along with millions of Jews, are losing their liberties, losing their livelihoods, their professions. They flee to the United States and are met at mainstream universities with a lot of the same anti-Semitic sentiment, this kind of general xenophobia that is very ubiquitous at the time. And where do they wind up getting positions, being accepted? At historically Black colleges and universities. And in fact, we're lucky enough to have in our community a woman named Joyce Mallory who attended Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi. And she was a student of Professor Ernst Barinsky, who was a German Jewish professor who actually is featured in this film. And we're excited to show that advocacy coming from both perspectives.
These are not necessarily stories we hear all the time.
Oh, absolutely not. And again, this is why this exhibit is so important, because it gives us a historical perspective on how people can work together, in particular, the Jewish community and African-American community. Another specific example, historically, of how the two communities have worked together, in the early 1900s, when African-Americans were migrating from the rural South to urban cities in the North, as they were making this transition, they encountered any number of problems, you know, housing, employment, education, et cetera. In 1909, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, was founded. And in 1910, the National Urban League was founded. Both organizations were founded to provide assistance to African Americans who were trying to make this transition. Interestingly enough, the Jewish community was very prominent in helping both organizations get established. That's a fact that few people know about, and it's something that this exhibit, you know, really helps to shine a light on and inform people.
Why do you think this kinship has existed over the decades and the centuries, really?
I have a couple thoughts on that, and, you know, probably the main, you know, connecting piece is this idea that both minority groups have met with some of the very same challenges. And those experiences, those narratives have been parallel in many instances. And I think that there was this general sense, and certainly following World War II, after the Jewish community was reeling from the devastation of the Holocaust, and this realization that there was this huge discrepancy between the American dream and what was actually going on, and that, you know, we were busy fighting, you know, racism and anti-Semitism abroad, and we had major problems in our own backyard that we needed to come together on. And that was a huge point of coalescence, I think, for the two communities.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, from my perspective, the two communities realized that, you know, obviously there were differences. But when we look at our history in this country, we had more in common. We had more similarities than not. And I think that caused a coalition to develop, a bond to develop very early on. But one of the other things I wanted to mention is that more recently, when we talk about the open housing marches here in Milwaukee, we often hear about Father Grappi, you know, Vell Phillips, the Commando Project, the Youth Council, which were very instrumental. But we don't hear about the Jewish connection to those marches and how the Jewish community helped and supported the marches. And in particular, there were several prominent Jewish attorneys who not only provided money, but provided free legal counsel. So when people got arrested or had some legal problems, they were there to assist people. That was absolutely essential, you know, to the success of the march. And the other thing is there was a very prominent Jewish doctor who provided free medical care when people were injured or whenever there were problems during the marches. These are little known facts, but essential facts that were essential part of making this a successful history story.
There were redlining practices in the Milwaukee area that excluded both African Americans and Jews, correct?
There were, and we do look at redlining. In fact, we have an entire three-part series that's coming up beginning very shortly here with Reggie Jackson kicking off the first program. And we felt like it was really important to look at that both in the context of the overall history, but in looking at the fact that here we are at the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches. And while there were some parallels between the African American and Jewish communities in terms of redlining, there were racially restrictive covenants that were in place that really affected the Black community. And there was a point where there had been mobility to a greater extent for the Jewish community, and that mobility really stopped for the African American community. And so we felt like it was so important to understand in looking to this, you know, really important moment that had a national impact. I mean, Milwaukee was on a national stage in terms of what was going on here. How can we move forward and affect positive change if we don't understand where we've come from, what has changed, but what still needs to be changed?
Redlining was so negatively impactful in the African-American community because as we look at ways to generate and create wealth in this community, home ownership is one of the essential ways that people do it. And because of the redlining laws, you know, African-Americans in some cases were not able to buy or they were restricted in terms of where they could buy. And because of those restrictions, their property values did not increase like in some other areas. And that had a devastating impact on the African-American community's ability to generate wealth, which we see the ramifications of that today.
There would be this temptation, I think, in talking about the relationship between the Jewish community and the African-American community to see it as this sort of constant state of being allied. But this was a complex relationship, wasn't it?
There definitely were complexities. And that's something we address in the exhibit as well, that this is a relationship that's ebbed and flowed. And there certainly have been periods where, you know, the the collaboration has been, you know, filled with more strife, and there have been times when it has really been much more of a coming together and seeing the benefit of coming together. But Ralph really spoke effectively to some of the differences he sees when we were discussing this a couple of weeks ago.
Yes. You know, as I said before, there are certainly commonalities, but there are distinctions as well. But I just wanted to say that, unfortunately, we have a tendency, and when I say we, you know, the broader society, the broader community, we have a tendency to focus on the negatives. And I think one of the things that's been disheartening to me is there's been a tendency to focus more on the differences between the African-American community and the Jewish community than the focus on the commonalities and how we work together. To me, that's so important. Now, we can't stick our head in the sand and pretend like, you know, certain things don't exist, but we can't focus on those things and let that become the narrative of the day.
What would you hope that people will take from understanding this history better?
I certainly hope that people will understand that we as people have more in common than not. And I hope that people will understand that we can make more progress by working together than being in our own little silos and, you know, working against each other. The other thing that I hope this exhibit does is I hope this exhibit is a catalyst to stimulate some ongoing conversation, dialogue, and action. You know, it's great to have a one-time exhibit and everybody feels good and, you know, everybody goes home. But it's more important to have some ongoing dialogue, some ongoing action where people are working together on some of our common problems and some of our common challenges. So I hope that this exhibit is going to be the springboard to make that happen.
And that's one of the wonderful things that has come out of this committee that we formed, which brought together leaders, activists, educators from both the African-American and Jewish communities. Everyone was so energized by this opportunity to have dialogue, to create, you know, public opportunities to explore meaningful, resonant topics and how they impact our society today. And what we've discussed is that exactly what Ralph said. We're really hoping this is going to be a springboard, that we are going to continue to foster dialogue. We're going to continue to do programming that addresses all of these important issues. And one of the things that we have in the exhibit that we're really hoping will be part of the engagement process is a call to action wall. I mean, it's one thing to read, to understand, but it's another thing to say, I'm going to be part of the change I want to see in the world. To quote Gandhi. But so we have activities listed from, you know, some things that are a little bit easier to things that require a bit more time and dedication. But we're asking everyone that comes into that space to make their mark and commit to doing something that is going to engage them in looking to affect positive change.
Well, Molly Dubin, Ralph Holman, thank you both for your time and congratulations on the exhibit.
Well, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Ralph Holman is the retired president and CEO of the Milwaukee Urban League. He's also the co-chair of the planning committee for the exhibit Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. It's open through late March at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. Molly Dubin is the museum's curator, and there is a link to more information at WUWM.com.
What happens when your William Shakespeare and the king who pays your salary wants you to write a play that isn't true? Do you do it or do you equivocate? We'll find out how a modern playwright imagines that scene when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. According to Merriam-Webster, the first known use of the word equivocate was in 1590. The dictionary further states the word has a couple of meanings: to use language especially with intent to deceive, and to avoid committing oneself in what one says.
Playwright Bill Kane says there is a further meaning, that equivocation can be a way to get to the deeper truth. How we use what appears to be the language of lies to tell a more profound truth is at the core of his 2009 play of the same name.
Equivocation opened at Next Act Theater this past weekend. I reached Kane at his home in New York and asked him to set the scene.
It's a play about William Shakespeare. And Shakespeare, at the beginning of the play, is confronted by Robert Cecil, who is the Prime Minister of England. And Cecil wants him to write a play for the king, which was Shakespeare's job since he was the king's playwright. But the story that Cecil wants him to tell is a propaganda story to support the king. And Shakespeare knows that it is not the truth, and he's given a choice: tell the truth and be killed, or lie and make a fortune. So those are his options. It's a play about telling truth in a difficult time.
How did you come to setting it that way? It is such a brilliant way of exploring that very thing of, like, how do you tell truth to power and still save your skin?
That's a good summary of it. I wasn't looking for a play when I wrote it, but the play came to me when I was in London on a vacation, and I went to the Tower of London, where I hadn't been for years, and I saw the rack. And over the rack, an instrument of torture, there was a sign, an official government sign, that said no one was ever tortured in the Tower because of religion. And technically, that's true. People were tortured because if you had a different religion, this was treason. If you were Catholic in a Protestant time, this was treason. But I thought, you know what? This is a lie, and we have to be very careful with truth these days. It was the time of weapons of mass destruction, so we were living in a war caused by a lie, as we're living now in a time in which lies seem to be the baseline rather than truth. So it began to occur to me that Shakespeare always had to figure out what he was going to say. Would he tell the king's truth or the real truth? And that's how the play came about.
Yes, and how he navigates that. And Robert Cecil is such a wonderful antagonist to him because while you could easily see him as the mouthpiece of the king, which he was officially, he also speaks a lot of truth as he is not speaking truth.
Cecil was the architect of modern England. He was a ruthless man, as was his father, Lord Burghley, and they put together, in fact, modern England, and they did it by killing the opposition, by silencing the opposition. But I don't want to get too historical on this. The play plays, I think, when you're watching it, like a modern play. Did you have that feeling?
Yes, very much so, just from reading it, even though these are historical figures.
Yes. So I don't want to get people too concerned about what they have to know about the gunpowder plot or any of that. It plays as a modern situation where a modern artist is trying to travel his way through, navigate his way through the lives of his time.
The other supporting characters, and it is a cast of six, but four of those actors play multitudes.
And my poor actors.
Yes. You gave them a lot of work to do, but I imagine as an actor it must be a lot of fun because you get to move lightning quick between lots of different points of view. And at the basis of all of this is a theater company trying to survive. And that hasn't changed in 500 years.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Theater companies are wonderful places, and I know you've been part of theater companies, but they're ragtag, they're sexual, they're funny, they're communities, they're families, and they have community fights and family fights. But somehow, they have to pull together, because every night at 8, you have to get on the stage and do something. So it's a community that's pressed to the breaking point, but finally holds its unity.
And they do it in such an interesting way that the folks who are the actors, not the parts that they're playing, but the
right.
actors, have such a wonderful, you've written such a beautiful telling of all of those things that a theater company is, that camaraderie, to quote Shakespeare, that band of brothers.
Yes. I ran a Shakespeare company for 7 years, and we performed in rep. So all of the theatrical stuff, none of it is made up. It all comes from the experience of living the Shakespearean world day and night for 7 years.
Well, and for people who don't know what rep is, that's where you've got one play performing at night and you're rehearsing another one in the afternoon that will go up and rotate through.
Yes, and not only just rehearsing two different plays, but you might be at Boston Shakespeare, which was the company. By the end of the season, we'd be doing four plays in rep. So you might be doing Hamlet, Winter's Tale, Comedy of Errors, and Romeo and Juliet. And the Shakespeare's company did that as well. And one of my favorite nights was an actor came in, and he threw the door of the theater open, looked at the set and said, okay, Hamlet tonight, and then went down and got in costume.
Because he wasn't sure which one he was supposed to do.
Had no idea. So, and like in this particular play, they're dealing with Hamlet and Macbeth and Richard III. They don't know what play they're in.
Right. And of course, Macbeth, or as we say in the theater, the Scottish play.
I'm not much on superstitions.
Right. So, a lot of theater people are.
Absolutely.
And so that's part of what's woven in here, too, is that we almost don't get Macbeth.
Right.
We get the gunpowder plot or whatever it's going to be called. Or we almost do, but we don't.
Well, to speak more seriously for a minute, there was an event in England, and it's the founding event of modern England, and it's called the gunpowder plot, in which a group of Catholics intended to blow up King James and the entire Parliament. Now, whether or not that actually happened, or certainly the details of how it happened, are in dispute. But Shakespeare wrote a play that was a gunpowder play. His play, Macbeth, is a response to the gunpowder plot. So that part of equivocation, which is the name of the play that we're talking about, my play, is actually rooted very deeply in history. Macbeth is a gunpowder plot play.
And, you know, I guess I knew that, but I didn't know that. And that's wonderful to think about Macbeth, if you know the play at all, to think about it in those terms, because, of course, James was Scottish.
Yep. So it's a Scottish play. And the play itself says, James, we are all here because your great ancestor was a very good guy, not Macbeth, but Banquo, and you are descended. And the entire play ends. The last line is, Hail, King of Scotland! Hail, King of Scotland! So you have a stage full of actors shouting out to the King of England, Hail, King of Scotland, who I expect probably stood up and applauded very, very lustily.
So as you look back, it's been almost a decade since this play was first performed, and it's been performed a lot. If you were writing it today, and you alluded to this earlier, that, you know, we're in a time now where truth is slippery and suspect, would you change anything?
I don't think so. I think the play play began at Oregon Shakespeare, and then it moved to played New York, Manhattan Theater Company, Arena Stage. It's done the grand tour. And in each of those productions, small adjustments were made to hone the play. But I think the text as it exists now is pretty much a well-oiled machine. I think it will sound different than it did at the start, because the echoes of the Iraq War are in the original production. But I think the whole idea of alternative facts will inform our understanding of the play now. We truly are now living in a very confusing time, because the idea of alternative facts, the idea that truth has no bearing, you can say anything you want and just assume it'll be taken true. And to oppose that is difficult. You begin to lose your equilibrium, your sense of balance. And what Shakespeare and the Shakespeare company in this play are trying to do is very hard. They're struggling to get a hold of what's true. And what they find out is true is not just a series of facts, but a sense of community, a sense of people committed to one another and committed to one another telling the truth. And I think that's what we're looking for in the world. So I think the resonance will be different, but deeper and stronger.
I can't help but think, as I read the play, that Shakespeare would be having a wonderful time writing right now.
What do you mean when you say that? Let me tease that out a bit.
I think that maybe the circumstances aren't dissimilar than what he was dealing with, just world politics. And I think he might be having some interesting times trying to get them on stage.
Well, here's the difficulty, though. if Shakespeare were writing today and had the same relationship to authority he had on the time, he would be on Donald Trump's payroll, because that's what he was at the time. He was working for the ruler, and the ruler was a compromised man. So the question would be, what would he be turning out? Because this was not a man who was committed to, by and large, an independent viewpoint. This was a man who was committed to getting a lot of money, to having the second biggest house in Stratford, to being an owner of a theater company. He was very much committed to his own self-interest. And in part because of that, in a time in which to have a strong point of view meant you get your head cut off, he prospered. So I don't know. If we were watching the plays that he were writing today, I don't know if we would be, if I would be with him or the opposition.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about. And in your play Equivocation, that's what we see him struggle with.
Yes.
And people keep appealing to his better nature, appealing to his sense of honor and all of that. And he kind of goes back and forth. And Cecil has his number.
Absolutely. He discovers a thing called equivocation, which actually was a philosophical theory at the time. And the easiest way to explain it would be to use, I always use Anne Frank. If you were hiding Anne Frank in your attic during the Second World War, and a Nazi came and knocked on the door and said, "Sorry, are you hiding the Frank family in your attic?" What would the right answer be? The true answer, the absolutely true answer, is yes, I am. But if you give that answer, if you speak that truth, disaster will follow, murder will follow. So the answer that seems untrue, which is to say no, is in fact the deeper truth. And that's called equivocation. Don't answer the question it's being asked. Answer the question beneath the question. So the play, in the play, Shakespeare is trying to use equivocation to get to a deeper truth. And as a matter of fact, all the way through the play Macbeth, Shakespeare is using not only the word equivocation, but the process of equivocation. So equivocating becomes a major element of the play.
Do you feel that you got to the deeper truth through equivocation?
I feel that when the play is done, there is usually a sense of euphoria. There's a speech in the play that I will misquote because it's been a while, but someone says to Shakespeare, "The truth, it's not a game, you know." And Shakespeare says in response, "Of course it's a game. It's the lies that are deadly serious." And he talks about the euphoric nature of actually being able to tell the truth. And what this particular text seems to do for actors is it gives them access to a truth within themselves. And an actor's truth is what frees an audience. It's what makes theater an ecstatic experience. And this particular set of words that I've put on paper seems to give actors and directors a route to find that kind of truth.
Well, here's to ecstatic experiences in the theater. I am all for that. Bill Kane, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so, so much.
Bill Kane's play Equivocation opened this past weekend at Next Act Theater. It runs through February 25th. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then contributor Jeanette Hurt joins us to suggest some worthy cheese to offer at your next gathering. Lake Effect continues with that in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. We have the good fortune every so often to have food writer Jeanette Hurt stop by the Lake Effect studio. Jeanette writes extensively about the Wisconsin cheese industry, and she visits us now to offer some suggestions for your next get-together.
Or even your next grilled cheese sandwich. She joined us in the studio and, more importantly, brought along a handful of cheeses for us to try. Great to see you again.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
It's always nice to have you here because you bring cheese with you when
yes.
you come to the station. And we'll get to the cheeses that you've brought along in just a moment. But let's talk about what's happening in the cheese world at the beginning of 2018.
Well, last year, specialty cheese in Wisconsin increased production by 7%.
And give people a working definition for specialty cheese.
Specialty cheese, artisan cheeses, flavored cheeses,
the interesting things, the not cheddar or
Colby,
yeah. But the really, really good cheeses, the ones that have interesting flavors, of which I have one really interesting blue cheese for you here.
I'm intrigued.
The other thing that they expect more of is cheese plates. There were more than 200,000 photos of cheese plates, especially by millennials last year. And they expect this trend to grow.
And so one imagines that it's not just that millennials are the only people eating cheese plates. They're the ones that are taking the pictures of the cheese plates.
Yes, and I don't think it's just millennials. If you go to any restaurant that has a good cheese plate, you will see people taking photos. Or people do photos of their own cheeses at home. It goes along with the whole selfie culture and taking photos of food culture, which has its own niche these days.
We'll call those cheesies.
Yes. So the other thing is, so specialty cheese and also strongly flavored cheeses. There are different ones out there where they combine interesting things, whether it's strong spices like paprika or herbs like chives. And we'll introduce one cheese. This is a Deer Creek Reserve cheese, and it's called the Blue Jay. It is a Wisconsin cream blue cheese, and it's made with juniper berries.
Oh, wow.
And juniper berries, of course, are what give gin its distinctive flavor. I have played around with this cheese, and I have found it really good to garnish cocktails that have gin in them. I could see this stuffing an olive for a gin martini, and that would go perfectly. But I've also used it for sweeter cocktails. I have used it to garnish on fruit with honey, and it's really good.
What's the ideal way to taste cheese? I know there are various ways. If you're doing a coffee tasting or a beer tasting or whatever, there are things that you're supposed to do with your mouth and nose. Is there a
technique? Well, the first thing you do is you look at it. That's what everyone says. Whether it's wine or beer, you look at it. You look at the colors. You look at, in this case, you look at the lovely blue veins. Mm-hmm. And then you smell. And with this, you can smell both the blue and the juniper and how they go so well. One of the things I learned is the best way to taste wine and cheese together is after you taste the wine, you taste the cheese. To taste it together, you mash the cheese on your tongue and you create a cheese highway. And then you sip the wine or the beer or the whiskey and you slurp it up and the combination. But I think just taste it.
It's kind of amazing that there is not a road in Wisconsin called the Cheese Highway. That is delicious.
It's just a lovely cheese.
Wow. And I think I've mentioned in the past that I did not used to be a blue cheese person, but I wonder if there's such a difference between a high quality blue cheese and, you know, what you often find on your salad at a restaurant.
Well, I think a lot of, especially the upscale restaurants in Milwaukee, use really quality blue cheese, and it's pretty easy to find. There's a lot of really good producers of blue cheese. This is one of the more interesting ones because it's flavored, and you don't think of blue cheese as being flavored.
Right. You think of blue cheese as having its own distinct flavor.
It is, but the juniper really complements the blue, and it's made with cream. It's really creamy. I think it would be a good addition to salad, or you could spread it over rye toast or crackers, adding a little bit of honey to add a sweetness to go with the sharpness.
Absolutely. So that was a Blue Jay variety of blue from Deer Creek.
Yes.
What do we have next?
Next, we have Marika Gouda Premium Gouda. This is Gouda that has been aged 12 to 18 months. So it's stronger than the typical Gouda you would think of. It's still mild. It's still nutty. But it's going to have more of an enhanced flavor. The other thing, if you've noticed, there's little tiny holes, which you wouldn't think, but that develops as the aging process of cheese. This is, of course, made by Marika Penterman at Holland's Family Farm.
Which is where?
It is in Thorpe, Wisconsin. Lovely, golden, almost in color. Smell it. It almost smells sweet.
Yeah.
It smells nutty.
And I will say, I may have mentioned before that I'm not typically a blue cheese fan. I may have also mentioned before that I love Gouda, and this is terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's really good. It is sweet.
It's just lovely. Hmm. When I have served cheese plates with it, the two cheeses that go the fastest, it doesn't matter where I've had these cheese plates. Most recently, I was one of the organizers of the American Society of Journalists and Authors conference in Chicago at Columbia College in November. And the two cheeses that went, of course, were Sartori's Bellavitano, which I've brought here, and this was their black pepper rubbed, mm-hmm. which took first place. And then Marika's Gouda. It doesn't matter what flavor on either of them, but those are the two cheeses that people end up just eating and eating and eating.
I'm looking at that brick that you brought with you and thinking that I could just...
Well, yeah, you could.
But
it
I
might
won't.
Be your lunch today.
Yeah.
The next one is Tallgrass Reserve, made by Landmark Creamery, and it's made by two Annas, Anna Landmark and Anna Thomas Bates. And it's they make their cheese off-site. They actually started making their cheese at Clock Shadow.
Oh, yeah.
And they mostly make sheep's milk cheese, but this is their one pasture-grazed cow milk cheese, which is aged at least 6 months. The rind, if you look at it, it's pretty rough.
It almost looks like the bark of a tree.
Well, you can see right here, paprika and olive oil. So, and then it's cave-aged. So that's why you've got these distinct. And this one... definitely stronger.
Okay.
And if you look on the label, it says, pair with cured meat or a shot of bourbon, which brings me to another cheese trend. It hasn't totally caught on, but the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board has done different classes, including cheese and whiskey pairing classes. And
thank
I think
you.
That's an interesting trend. But smell it. It's really earthy, a little bit grassy. It's lovely, but this is a lot stronger than the Gouda.
Yeah. Hmm. Again, I'm not disappointed.
It's wonderful. This one would, I think, go really well in a grilled cheese sandwich.
Absolutely,
melted.
Yeah. Maybe on some sourdough bread.
Yes. And I think it would go well with chutney or a little bit of a sweet jam to contrast with its earthiness. Now, this next one is the cave-aged bandage cheddar from Bluemont Dairy Company. And they have a cave, and they age cheeses not just their own but other cheesemakers. This smells, it smells like a cave. And it's not cheddar... like we think of in Wisconsin typically. Very earthy.
Yes, for sure.
One thing the cheesemaker Willie Lehman has always experimented with using different bacteria. He tries to get it as local as possible, whether it's in the soil or air. And he has sprayed his cheeses with different things to get the combination he wants. As he says, it's made from pasteurized milk, rennet, cultures, salt, and love with a capital L. You can taste the cheddar.
Right. I was going to say it tastes, but it's not necessarily that sharp.
It's funkier.
Yeah. In a good way.
It is. It's got a little bit, I mean, it tastes earthy. It's not the cheddar that you'd expect. But bandage cheddars are more traditional in England. I've seen some in California. But Willie is one of the only ones in Wisconsin doing the bandage, which means they actually wrap it in, like, bandages
right.
and age it. And then you have that rougher, moldier sort of...
I'm going to take a picture of this because
people
will want to see what we were talking about.
They're all wonderful cheeses, all different, and they're all made from cow's milk. Wisconsin cows, to be exact. So it's interesting how they are all so very different.
And I don't know that I can pick a favorite of those four because they were all terrific. I think if I had to choose, I would go with either the Tallgrass or the Gouda, but that's really just a personal preference.
I think that's the thing. And the other thing is what kind of mood you're in. If you're having an after-dinner dessert, I would think maybe the blue cheese, especially with honey, that sure. would be sort of a dessert. If you're looking for something to snack in the afternoon, probably the Gouda, because you'd probably want more. But if you're looking for something with a little more oomph, go with the last two cheeses, because one of those, and this, of course, the cave-aged bandaged cheddar, his cheeses have won several big awards in the American Cheese Society. And they're all interesting, all different. And I think they're a good representation of all the cheeses that you can find here in Wisconsin. And we're really blessed that we have such great cheese. All of these came from Larry's Market. I often stop in there.
I imagine you have frequent flyer miles at Larry's Market.
Yes.
So before I let you go, are there cheeses that are on your radar that you're particularly looking forward to tasting this spring?
Well, usually every year before the American Cheese Society, the cheesemakers in Wisconsin come up with some new ones. And I don't know what they're going to be because although we're mostly known for our cows, we are the largest producers of goat's milk and the largest producers of sheep's milk. We are not the largest producers of cow's milk, but we are the largest producer of cheese. So that, I think, is interesting. And it's interesting to see all the different people who get into cheese and then how they evolve. Of the cheesemakers here, I would say that Landmark Creamery is the youngest, and they only started making cheese in 2013. Wow. So
they've come a long way
they
in
have,
5 years.
And they still make their cheese at other people's creameries because they don't have the equipment, but they just bought a new warehouse where they eventually hope to put equipment in.
That is fantastic. Well, we will look forward to our next visit from you because you always bring us some really amazing cheese, I have to say. Jeanette Hurt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Jeanette Hurt is a Milwaukee-based food writer. Her books include Drink Like a Woman, The Idiot's Guide to Food and Wine Pairing, and The Cheeses of Wisconsin. And she's the Lake Effect Ambassador to the cheese world.
So that would make her the Kurdish ambassador.
Well, that's one way to look at it.
That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Wedge of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned before it goes right past your eyes. Fresh air is next.